Radiolab is supported by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call the shots on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
This is Radiolab.
Today, a whole hour on the Galapagos Islands, the place that inspired Charles Darwin to create his theory of evolution, whose basic ingredients are lots of time, isolation, and then constant change. But Darwin didn't consider this possibility. What if, on these islands, thousands of tourists arrive every day carrying fruits and chocolates and souvenirs, jumping from island to island?
Now, the Galapagos government spends millions of dollars checking all of the goods that come in and out, trying to quarantine the ones that might have things that are a problem. But what if simply putting your foot on the ground can completely transform a place?
Hola, ¿cómo estás? Hola, buenos días.
Back to producer Tim Howard.
So I met this woman named Heinke Jaeger, who is like a plant scientist.
I'm the restoration ecologist at the Charles Darwin Foundation.
Here we are in Los Gemelos.
We were going to look at these incredible craters called Los Gemelos.
Oh, I almost got hit by a car.
And as we're walking along the path,
see?
She's like, oh wait, look at this.
Right here.
She points just to the right of the path.
Look at this species here.
Small leafy green thing.
They call it yantén in Spanish. It is it's plantago. I think in the U.S. they call it the wrench of the white man?
The wrench of the white man?
Yes. It's actually the footprint of the white man. Doesn't matter. Point is,
it's an introduced species.
It's introduced. It's found in Europe, North Africa. Shouldn't be here.
And you have this one here.
She points right next to it.
Called Taruscanthia.
Shrubby thing, green and white leaves.
It has a terrible common name in English. I'm not going to say it.
Wandering Jew. Basic houseplant. You can buy it at Home Depot. But there it is in the Galapagos.
And
along this path.
Just looking to the right and the left.
And then she just starts counting the number of invasive species at 1, 2, 3, 4.
As you can see here, it's only right next to the trail, but not so much further. And
you see that they're only there for this border of about 5 to 10 inches along the edge of that path.
Why? Why would that be?
Because Heinke said what happens is that tourists, they'll be back in their home country. They'll be walking around in a garden or a park, and it'll be filled with tiny seeds.
The seeds stick to shoes and socks and trousers.
They wear those trousers on the plane, and then they wear them when they come here.
And then people walk and then just distribute or disperse the seeds along the trail.
Wow. Now, most of these plants are actually probably harmless. And, you know, like you said, Galapagos National Park, they spend tons of money, tons of time trying to keep invasives out. But fact is, there's only so much you can do. And every once in a while, one of these hitchhikers slips under the radar and just wreaks havoc.
You just grabbed it, just like that. You just put your hands around it.
Yeah, but that's only possible the first day.
So while we were in the highlands of Santa Cruz, Heinke took me through the woods to meet this guy named Arno.
My name is Arno Cimerom.
He's an ornithologist.
From the University of Vienna.
And shortly after we walked up, he reached out into this tree and he grabbed this tiny little baby finch right off the branch.
He's adorable. Oh my God, he looks a little bit furry, almost.
Really tiny.
Vulnerable.
A fledgling of a warbler finch. So the warbler finch is the smallest of the Darwin's finches.
You can like see him pulsing kind of as he's breathing.
So Darwin's finches. In short, Darwin, when he visited Galapagos, he collected a lot of specimens of finches, took them back to England, and eventually he realized that the beaks had all adapted. They were all a little bit different depending on which island the finches lived on.
Were the beaks adapted to whatever the finches
were
eating?
One island's finches had literally like the beak would be shaped sort of long, and then the next island, it would look almost the same but much shorter. And this became one of the most important pieces of evidence that, you know, when animals would move from one place to another, that they would begin to differentiate based on what
so
they were really
these are very,
living.
Very important
very
beaks.
Important. Yeah.
But speaking of beaks, that finch that Arno was holding.
He's just a thread.
His beak?
But you see the, especially this side is extremely huge.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, the nostrils have big holes.
Yeah. Ah, poor little guy. Yeah.
Something had gotten inside this little finch's nostrils, drilled these holes, and it was now eating the flesh on the inside of the bird's nostrils. Oh. Scientists first began to see this in 1997 when they started to find nests full of dead baby finches. At first, nobody had any idea what kind of creature it was, so they began to frantically study it. I actually visited one of the main researchers, Piedad Lincango. She's lived in Galapagos for over a decade. And she showed me her lab.
I'm surrounded by shelves, and on the shelves there are these tiny little plastic cups that are filled with flies.
This is the villain.
Pero parece solo cualquier tipo de
a little black fly. Looks like every other fly.
Se parece, es del mismo grupo de la mosca doméstica.
In fact, Piedad says
es de la misma familia.
That it's actually in the same family as the regular house fly.
Huh.
But it's actually a bot fly called Phalornis downsi.
Do you just spell Phalornis downsi?
Yeah, it's P-H-I-L, I can't spell out loud. Phalornisdownsi.
Okay.
Huh. Phalornis actually means bird-loving.
That's Charlotte Costin. She's a researcher.
At the Charles Darwin Foundation.
She says there's actually very little known about the fly. They're not sure where it came from or quite how it got here, but here's what they do know. The adult fly seems to be harmless.
The adult fly is actually vegetarian. It feeds on flowers and, we think, decomposing fruits.
Baby flies, they're not vegetarian.
They will, you know, suck blood. And what happens is that as soon as birds start laying eggs,
mother flies swoop in
and lay their eggs on the base of the nest.
Sort of underneath the finch eggs.
Once the eggs hatch, the eggs hatch of the flies as well, and the larvae.
Wriggling little larvae will crawl out from the bottom of the nest, up the finch's body, into its beak.
And they go into the noses and of the baby finches.
And just start eating.
You know, they basically feed on the blood of the baby birds.
How did these little fly babies know? I mean, that's a very specific trip to take.
Good question. We're still trying to figure that out. You know, we assume that it was carbon dioxide.
Carbon dioxide.
From the breathing of the
wow.
birds. Wow. Yeah.
She's opening a box with some of the birds, the little pinzones, the finches. Oh, God.
Esto no es normal.
Piedad showed me this tiny little dead finch in this box.
En el cerebro, sí? Wow, there's a little hole into the brain of this little finch. Oh, my God. Un hueco en la espalda? They ate the whole back of this little finch.
Wait, so how big a problem is this?
Well, I talked to one scientist.
Sonia Kleindorfer, I'm professor in animal behavior at Flinders University, South Australia.
And she told me that researchers recently did a survey of finch nests.
Four different species on two islands, and all research groups found about 95% mortality in the nest.
95% of the babies were dead?
Yeah.
And Arno told me
that this year, small tree finches, so far we had only two nests with fledglings and all the others were dead. Yeah. So it's a lot. Yeah.
But even worse,
so far we found Phalornis on 13 islands.
The fly is spreading island to island.
Is there any time scale we should worry about? Like, are these finches disappearing very fast, very slowly?
Depends on the species.
We have at least five species that are known to be facing extinction. And another six in serious decline.
These five species, does that mean that they may go extinct in the next 5 years, in the next 50 years?
I hope not, but You know, we have the case of the mangrove finch. We have 60 to 80 individuals left.
Wow.
It's a race against time.
So, for starters, they put up all these traps.
Lo que tenemos aquí es una trampa.
And they took me outside. They showed me where the traps are.
A trap hanging from a tree here.
And you see them actually all over Santa Cruz. These bright yellow traps hanging from trees.
Tenemos una mosca.
Filornis, una hembra.
And this is to control the fly population?
No, no. They would need like millions of traps every few feet to do that. This is just to grab a few flies, take them back to the lab, and study them, so they can learn how to fight them. Charlotte and Piedad's fantasy is that the flies
use a pheromone to attract the opposite sex.
Sería fantástico.
It would be lovely if we could find something like that.
Because if they could find that chemical, that love chemical that the flies use to attract each other, they could disrupt it.
Confuse the flies.
And screw up their mating.
Uh-huh.
Another possibility is
sterile insect technique.
Sterilize male flies and introduce them back into the wild.
So that the female mates with a sterile fly and obviously doesn't produce fertile eggs.
If they can't make babies, the population will crash.
And in some cases, you can successfully eradicate a species.
This is very much like the mosquitoes.
Very much.
That Andy talked about a couple podcasts ago.
Right, but here's the problem.
Ese es un sueño a largo plazo que tenemos.
If they're gonna release sterilized male flies into the wild, they have to be able to raise
producción de miles, incluso de millones.
Millions of these flies in the lab.
En este caso, una hembra que nació hoy día.
And they're trying like crazy.
She's showing me all of the larvae that hatched today. And
Piedad showed me four baby flies that had just hatched.
And they're in these little cups.
Sí, cuatro hoy día de este nido.
But she told me that these four flies will probably die because they always die.
Right now, we have huge problems trying to rear Phylornis in captivity, which is ironic given, you know, how abundant it is in the wild.
Se logró criar tres individuos adultos.
When I was there, Piedad told me that so far they had only successfully raised three adult flies.
When you're saying they needed millions.
Yeah. And meanwhile, the finch populations are just getting decimated. Charlotte says that they're trying to respond. Ornithologists have started to notice some new behaviors. For instance,
adult birds picking the larvae out of the nostrils of the baby birds.
And what we're starting to see is that they're beginning to consume them.
You mean eat the fly larvae?
Yeah, which 15 years ago, they would never do.
Back in the year 2000,
Sonia and some colleagues tried feeding the finches some fly larvae.
And if ever there were a look of disgust on a finch face, that was it. So I think there's been a change.
They're also seeing baby finches climbing up over each other, just struggling to get away from the larvae on the bottom of the nest.
And they'll even start standing on the nest rim just to avoid being eaten.
But when I asked Charlotte what she makes of all of these changes, she said,
I think probably too little, too late.
But then Sonia told me something really surprising.
Yeah, that was a very unexpected discovery.
Takes a couple steps to get there, but just to set it up, back in 2000, she was on Floriana Island for the first time.
I started studying Darwin's finches.
In particular,
three tree finch species, the small, the medium, and the large. And we went out and we set up our mist nets and we caught the birds and we measured them.
And the thing to note is that even though these are our three different species, they're actually really hard to tell apart visually. So she would end up relying on their songs, their mating calls.
Yep.
Do you remember the song types? Could you whistle them for me?
Oh, yes. It's a very simple song. The small tree finch goes something like chit-chit-chit-chit-chit-chit. That's a small tree finch. And the medium tree finch is just a bit slower. For the medium, it's a chit-chit-chit-chit. For the large, chee-chee-chee-chee.
Wow, it's like a soprano saxophone and an alto and a tenor or something like that.
That's right. So we just, you know, sat in the forest and we would always quiz each other. What's that? What's that? And we all agreed.
Because the calls are really distinct. Easy to tell apart.
But the interesting thing was from year to year, it got more difficult.
Sonia says each time she'd go into the field, the songs sounded like they were starting to blur together.
Yeah. Then when I showed up after a few years again, I was truly even more perplexed.
She thought, God, why can't I tell these finches apart?
It was very confusing.
Am I losing my touch?
But that shouldn't really happen. You should actually get better with experience,
yeah,
not worse. And that's where I thought, oh, something's changed in the system. I like to think of it as a kind of Darwin Finch, you know, sleuthing adventure.
So Sonia and her team rounded up some of the birds they tagged.
We collected genetic samples.
Got some DNA.
And song samples.
Made some recordings.
Yep.
Brought all this stuff into the lab.
Analyzed the genetic samples.
And had this terrible realization.
That the large tree finch is now extinct.
Totally gone from the island. So you really only had two species left. You had the small tree finches and the medium tree finches. And based on that genetic data, the small tree finches, not doing great, but compared to the medium tree finches, they are, because the medium tree finches were on the brink of extinction.
Like the large ones.
Yeah. But then she sees something amazing in that genetic data. She sees a small group of birds who have mixed up genes.
A hybrid cluster.
Some genes from the small tree finches and some from the medium tree finches.
Huh. What does that mean?
Well, it means that these two different finches had started having babies together, which should never actually happen because these are totally separate species.
That's really the classical definition of a species.
It's like a biological rule about who you're not going to make a baby with.
So they choose not to breed, even if they could.
For, who knows, maybe a million years, the medium tree finch has patrolled that boundary. Like, I've got my thing over here, and you got your thing over there. But then along come the flies. And all of a sudden, like over maybe 20 years, these medium tree finches, they start to break their own biggest rule and they start to mate outside of their own kind.
And these hybrid finches, are they doing better against the flies?
Well, there's a couple clues that say maybe. Yeah. For example, when you look in the nests,
they seem to have fewer parasites.
And they seem to have more babies that survive.
15%.
Wow.
Whereas the numbers were very small for the medium tree finch and smaller for the small tree finch.
Wow. I dare say that sounds kind of hopeful.
It does. Yeah.
Now, the jury is still very much out on what will happen. But
if the hybrids do have a fitness advantage,
and if they survive, we may be witnessing in hyperspeed the creation of an entirely new species.
It would possibly be one of the first vertebrate examples of speciation in real time that we can observe.
So, tucked into the story of these finches is the story of Galapagos. Same exact story that Darwin saw, these processes that he described, that just never, ever stop. It's this unending struggle. One last thing. My last night there, I went to meet up with that guy, Leonidas, who was running for mayor. I met him at this pizza place. The election had happened the night before. And
did he win?
No, Buccelli, the incumbent, won. So we go outside, chat.
Leonidas Parrales. My name is Leonidas Parrales. I was running as a mayor.
Turns out he speaks some English. So we do this interview in English. And I'm almost embarrassed that I wanted to talk to him because I think the dude is just going to be so down and out.
Exactly the opposite. He was so joyful.
To have lost?
That's what I thought.
You're not sad? You're not sad?
I know, never, Fred. Today
and he's like, friend, this is a field of four. The other three all have money behind them, and you see their flags all over Santa Cruz. I just came in second.
Whoa.
The guy who wins, he spent $500,000. I spent, what, $2,000?
Friend, it's the beginning. It's the beginning of a new future for the Galapagos Island.
We are ascending.
And we keep, we have our dreams up. So nature has a voice now. The sea lion has a voice in us. The tortoises has a voice in us. The penguin and everyone.
So something is happening.
That's exactly how he sees it.
So thank you very much for the interview. I hope you enjoyed the Galapagos Island.
Producer Tim Howard.
And before we close, very special thanks to Matthew Judas Kilty, without whom Tim would have been crushed just by the sheer amount of tape that he gathered.
Indeed. Also thanks to Dylan Keefe for original music. Thanks to Trish Dolman and Screen Siren Pictures, Alex Galifant, Matthias Espinoza, the naturalist guide from the first chapter, who wrote this song, Pico Pinzon. He's also a well-known musician in Galapagos, it turns out. Thanks to the Galapagos National Park, Charles Darwin Foundation, Island Conservation, and the Galapagos Conservancy. I'm Chad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krolwich.
Thanks for listening.
Hi, this is James Gibbs calling from Syracuse, New York.
Hi, my name is Charlotte Corson.
Hi, this is Sonia Kleindorfer from Flinders University.
And I have been asked to leave a message for the credits. Radiolab is produced by WNYC.
And distributed by NPR.
And distributed by NPR.
Radiolab is produced by Jad Abumrad. Our staff includes
Ellen Horn, Soren Wheeler,
Tim Howard, Brenna Farrell,
Molly Webster, Melissa O'Donnell,
Dylan Keefe, Jamie York,
Lynn Levy, Andy Mills, and Kelsey Padgett.
With help from Ariane Wack,
Matt Kielty,
Barry Finkel, and Lily Sullivan.
Special thanks to Kate Hopkins, Henry Nichols,
Jason Kobler, Carol Ambassett, Robert Lamb, and Trish Dolman.
Hope that was good enough.
Okay, I hope that was okay. Thanks.
That's it. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for the opportunity. Bye-bye.
End of message.